The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist. On this podcast, we explore the science and provide inspiration and skills for living your happiest, most fulfilling, and healthiest life. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Peter Sprigg, who's Assistant Professor of Rehab Medicine and Assistant Professor of Orthopedics at Emory University. He's a physical therapist by profession. He's a board-certified clinical specialist in orthopedic physical therapy and currently sits on the Orthopedic Specialty Council for the American Board of Physical Therapy Specialties, serving a four-year appointment beginning in January 2018. Dr. Sprigg has extensive clinical experience working with collegiate athletes in an interprofessional team setting and has assisted in the development and implementation of screening procedures assessing for musculoskeletal injury risk for collegiate and professional sports organizations. He's an active research agenda exploring musculoskeletal injury risk reduction in athletic and first responder populations. And today we're going to have a wonderful conversation about movement in general. What kinds you need, what you should do to prevent injury, both as an athlete as well as throughout your life to be able to continue moving as we age. So Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sharon, for having me. I'm very excited to talk about my favorite topic, which is human movement.
Oh, wonderful. So Peter, give us a little bit of background about the work that you've done.
So working with athletic populations in a university in South Florida, primarily Division II athletes, I was able to work a lot with the athletics department. We were trying to understand how or even if we could predict injury in our athletes. We wanted to try to keep them healthier. There's a lot of injuries that occur with collegiate athletics, and some of them we thought may be preventable. And the first thought was to see if we could identify who in our athletic cohort may be at risk for injury. And understanding that the biggest risk for athletic injury is a history of previous injury, went after those folks first, but then also looked at the individuals that were coming in and that didn't have a recent injury history. And what we found is that one of the factors that did correlate with injury risk was a lack of movement competence and an asymmetry in side-to-side movement with certain movements that we tested, or the inability to move their body through space with some level of competence.
So Peter, tell me what more, how like a person who's not an athlete, like how does that apply to all of us? Like when you say asymmetry or movement competence, how would we be able to tell if that's something that we have?
So I would say just be vigilant about understanding how you feel when you move. And for instance, if you squat, what does it feel like when you squat? First of all, are you able to get down to a lower squat position? Are you very limited? Do your hips flex? Do your knees bend? Do your ankles bend? Or are you very stiff? And if you're very stiff, then think about what needs to happen or occur to allow you to attain that deeper squat position. Now, what I would do for just general populations that aren't really athletes is try to look at the tasks that you do most throughout the day. And whether that's some type of yard work or gardening that involves maybe getting to a half kneeling position or bending over, try to look inward at how you feel during those movement processes. And is there a pinch somewhere? Is there tightness that you feel somewhere? And that'll give you an indication perhaps of areas that need a little bit more attention.
And let's say we identify, for example, a limitation in our ability to stretch or reach for something. Once we have that awareness, how can we work through it?
So that depends on a couple of things, primarily what's causing the problem with that movement. I'm going to use an example from myself. I was digging underneath my deck. I wanted to put a little bit of extra drainage around our pool. So I'm under my deck and I'm in kind of a half kneeling lunge position, and I'm kind of moving around in that position. I noticed a little bit of tightness in through my hip. So I worked on mobility in through my hip over the next few days and then went back down into that same position, not underneath my deck, but just tried it out and found that the pinch was improved. Now, there may be pinching that could occur, not because of a mobility problem. I may not be able to stretch it out per se. I get a pinch perhaps because of the way that the muscles are stabilizing the hip joint. Perhaps my gluteal muscles aren't controlling my femur, the big bone in the upper part of our thigh that makes up the ball of our ball and hip socket joint. Those muscles are a little weaker, or if they're not contracting at the appropriate time, that could cause my hip to turn inward a little bit and cause a pinching at the joint, primarily probably the labrum. So if mobility is an issue, you can stretch it, and you know you've done well by testing that position again. But if it's not a mobility issue, if it's not because of your tight, what you can do is get yourself into that position. If you feel a pinch, pause, come out of that position for a second, and then try to go into that position a little slower or perform that position or that movement without causing that pinch. So what it does is it forces you to think in terms of using mindfulness for your movement processes. Every movement that you can do that's really not, or you can even think of this even in the gym, the movement that's athletic or non-athletic can turn into an exercise for your neuromuscular system. Trying to identify when problems are occurring by how you feel during those movement processes, and then either attending to them through stretching or by trying to perform the movement in a manner that's a little bit different, that allows you to feel a little bit different.
And when you work with patients, so let's say somebody has pain in the hip, maybe they were inappropriately using their hip, what are the types of things you look at during an evaluation as a physical therapist?
So we're going to look at a local hip joint examination. We're going to look at range of motion of the hip. We'll take some measurements. We'll do in medicine, what we call special tests, which are different ways that we'll bend or move the joint to try to provoke symptoms. That gives us an idea of what structures might be involved. And then we're going to also take a look as physical therapists at how the muscles perform in isolation, and then how the muscles perform with movement processes. So individuals that come in with a hip problem, I'm going to look at how they perform just in a single leg standing position. I'm going to look at how they perform when they step off of a step, like stimulating going downstairs or stepping off of a curb. I'm going to look at how they function going into a squat position. And then based upon what I see with all those movement patterns, I'll break down the movement further to try to identify the underlying impairments that are associated with the problem that they're experiencing. And by impairments, I mean, is the hip joint stiff? Is it a muscle problem? If it is it a strength problem, a muscle timing problem? And that allows me then to prescribe the appropriate interventions to try to improve the movement processes in that individual.
I see. And then how do you design a program around that? What do you do next?
So if someone's having difficulties in single limb standing, it may not only be coming from their hip. So we have to boil it down a little bit. What I can do is put them from a single leg standing position. If they have trouble with balance, I can take them out of that single leg standing position and then have them go into what we call a half kneeling position, where their knee of the involved side is on the floor and the other side, their opposite foot, is forward. So you're kind of half kneeling, if you will, where front foot is flat on the floor, the front knee is bent, and you're bearing weight through your other knee. What that does is it takes away the ankle from the involved side. So I can know if someone's having a balance problem that's occurring primarily from lumbopelvic hip region, or is there a problem also or only with their strategies of balancing with the ankle. Once we identify where the problem is coming from, then we can isolate balance exercises to try to improve the processes of balance in the areas that need the work. And we're going to do that in a manner that is kind of random in regard to activity. In other words, I want random input coming into the central nervous system. I'm not going to change the movement processes by doing 3 sets of 10 with a weight, et cetera. You change movement processes not through what we call block training, but more through random training. So I'm going to challenge the movement system to maintain balance and provide challenges through changing the environment around that person's balance to allow for more of an input of complexity with that environment. So the more complex situations I can throw and challenge at that patient, the quicker they're going to learn to change their movement strategies.
And as people are doing that, they should keep paying attention to what's pain-free and what's comfortable.
That's correct. Yeah. Number one, because pain can change motor output. We know that a person with a painful joint or a person coming off of injury, their central nervous system is going to process movement differently than if they're not in pain or if they didn't have an injury. So we don't want to exercise them into painful patterns. No pain, no gain maybe has a place in trying to regain joint mobility following surgery, but does not have a place in trying to restructure or improve motor processes of an individual. It's trying to improve someone's balance. So not exercising in pain. And often what I'll do is if they do a movement that looks better to me, I'll pause, I'll make them pause and have them describe it to me. And they'll describe it in whatever term kind of comes to their mind. And then I try to have them utilize that feeling with every task that they do going forward. So I may have them use that if it felt different and it felt good to balance a certain way or move a certain way in that half kneeling position, then we'll go ahead and try to apply that same feeling with other tasks that challenge single leg standing, such as stepping up onto a step, stepping off of a step, stepping sideways, walking along a narrow pathway where you're walking in tandem, things of that nature.
What do you recommend when a person has had an injury that is going to cause pain, so they can't find the way to do it that doesn't invoke pain? So for example, let's say a person's a runner and they tear their meniscus. And if they're going to go for a walk or even a slow run just to try and get back into it, they may feel that, they're going to have pain. Like, is there a way to do that will help them rehabilitate and get back to doing the activities they want to do?
Mm-hmm. That's a person that may need some medical management in addition to physical therapy, maybe perhaps prescription medication, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, Tylenol, whatever a physician would prescribe to help with pain processes and inflammation would be appropriate. Sometimes those problems are surgical problems and can't be resolved with conservative measures. But typically that works in combination with physical therapy. So what we will do for PT with that individual also is to reduce the demands on that injured structure through education and activity modification. So if I have a runner that's running 20 miles a week and they're coming in with a meniscal problem, it's not allowing them to run that distance. But you know, the last thing you want to say to a runner is, let's stop running. They'll never come back to see you again. So you find some type of middle ground where perhaps you do a reduced running program, reduce their volume, maybe by 50% or 25%, whatever you feel would be appropriate based upon the patient's symptoms. And then also add some breaks within the run. So instead of running for maybe 20 minutes straight, you have them run for 3 minutes and then walk for a minute and see how they do in regard to symptoms with that type of regimen. And then gradually, as they start to improve and recover from their injury, they'll be able to resume their normal level of activity. The other thing we can do too is try to change the way in which the body is moving around that injured structure. Maybe there's a lack of, again, hip control as they land on that leg. You know, our body often works on what's called a feed forward system of neuromuscular control. As we run, using the example of the runner with this, as we run, before our foot strikes the ground, our glute muscles are firing, they're contracting. What they're doing is preparing the body to accept the load that's going to be placed upon it. And folks that have knee injuries or hip injuries, those muscles are latent. They don't fire before the foot hits the ground. They kind of come on a little bit later. And that causes less of a control through that long bone in the upper part of the thigh, the femur. It can internally rotate and place more stress on the knee. So what we need to do is try to bring those muscles back into form, get them to fire when they should, from a temporal or time standpoint, and make sure that they have enough strength to be and muscular endurance to be able to handle the loads that can be placed on them with running.
And how would you go about getting the muscles in the glutes to fire earlier or appropriately in that scenario?
So we need to do an input to that neuromuscular system that is random, like we talked about before, and it's implicit. That's the way we get the muscles to work in a matter in a manner that is improved in regard to neuromuscular control and timing, and it becomes automatic. So they don't have to think about doing it. What we can't do is assume that we're going to change that muscle by strengthening it alone. We'll strengthen it if it's weak. We'll pay attention to what load we place on it. We'll use reps and sets that allow them to fatigue somewhere between 8 to 12 repetitions to make sure we're going to get true strength gains going forward. If it's a sprinter or a jumper, I may be more focused on power. So we'll do some elements to try to improve muscle quality in that manner. But to improve the timing, the temporal aspect of how those muscles work with the rest of the body, we need to utilize positions and body movements that the patient doesn't even realize that they're using those muscles in an appropriate manner. And we also need to get away from understanding that three sets of 10 principle. It's something called block training. You're going to pick up a task pretty quickly with block training, but you're not going to retain it. An example can be if you're going to try to get someone to improve free throw shooting in basketball, you can have two different scenarios where perhaps you put someone on a free throw line and they shoot 100 free throws in a row. You have a second person where they shoot 100 shots all around the basket, not necessarily from the free throw line. If you compared the two, immediately after that task, the person that stood at the free throw line will be better at free throws. They'll have more improvement than the person that shot all around. But if you brought them back 2 or 3 days later, the person that did the random task will have better performance than the person who just did the free throws. And in many cases, the person who did the free throws may regress in regard to their ability to perform that task.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, it makes me think about, you know, cross training.
Yes.
You know, as people who are trying to, for example, do one sport and excel at it, the value of, like you're saying, maybe doing other tasks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and getting them also to, so you have that randomization or block training versus block training, but then also get them to use those muscles in a way that's implicit. So I may have them perform some squats with a band around their knees, maybe perform 2 or 3 squats. The band is requiring them to utilize their external rotators in their hip, not allowing that knee to come in. They don't know that's what the goal is, but they're doing that. Or I could have them and maybe have them in that half kneeling position with a big dowel, something like a broomstick in front of their toes, and have them move their knee forward, putting their knee to the outside of that broomstick, 2 or 3 repetitions of that, and then have them go up into a standing position and look at themselves in the mirror and bend their knee a little bit without it coming in. So a variety of tasks that we can block together in a 3 to 5 minute block that challenge those muscles in a variety of different ways, not too many repetitions in a row, and that it's implicit. There's a goal that the patient's trying to get to. They're not focusing on the muscle per se, they're focusing on the task. So by performing the task and performing the task correctly, they're utilizing the requisite muscle timing and muscle activity to perform that. That's been shown to be translational. And that is where movement becomes more automatic underneath those conditions.
And Peter, as you say that, you know, we've been talking about injury and in some sports and exercise, but it has a lot of application for people who just want to grow old gracefully, you know, continue to be able to do that. How does movement, you know, what types and what activities, how can we increase our ability to continue to be independent and active as we get older?
So I think that the answer is not sport and not exercise as we normally think of it. Exercise is good and exercise is necessary. And if you look at exercise and strengthening for individuals as they age, it's very, very important for them to maintain their strength. We'll lose muscle strength by a significant amount, maybe by 10 to 20% reduction each decade of life, especially after the age of 70. And so that loss of muscle mass can be prevented. You don't have to lose muscle mass. Individuals that train or perform strength training maintain their muscle mass. However, maintaining muscle mass with strength training is one component. Okay. Maybe if you do that 3 times a week, just putting activity into your muscles, that's fine. What we also have to understand is that there's a whole lot of other demands on the system that are placed on the system that strength alone can't overcome. Balance, being able to engage in proper and safe movement around more complex environments, those are all things that isolated strengthening, lifting weights, isolating your muscles, don't accomplish. And one of the biggest things that individuals can do as they age is to keep themselves active, and active in a variety of movements. And if we think of this thoughts now regarding physical inactivity, sedentary behavior, and exercise, there's room for a thought of non-exercise movement. There's an acronym out there called NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, where we can actually utilize physical activity with normal things that we do throughout the day, tasks like gardening, housework, yard work, and individual things that would challenge us from a movement standpoint that aren't necessarily raising our heart rate a significant amount. Those are all extremely beneficial, and beneficial not just from a movement standpoint, but also from a metabolic standpoint. And I guess you can argue that the metabolic standpoint and movement are very closely related. So from a health standpoint, movement in itself, not just exercise alone, is extremely helpful. Cut down on your time in front of the television, cut down on your sedentary time with reading and sitting, and try to add a little bit more meaningful activity, task-related activity.
So Peter, I get asked this a lot from my patients, where some are quite active, like you said, doing activities like gardening, house cleaning, but they don't necessarily do formal exercise, you know, as people envision CDC guidelines, which is, you know, do 150 minutes of aerobic activity a week, so they don't schedule a walk. From what you're saying, that home movement type of activity incorporated into the day is fine and perhaps even more beneficial in the way that we want to prolong our ability to stay active as we get older.
I would say yes, absolutely. And what we understand now, again, from the research that's come out over the past 10 or 15 years, is that you can't counteract 7 or 8 hours of physical inactivity with an hour of physical activity. There's still going to be metabolic consequences to that long sustained physical inactivity time. So interspersing activity throughout your day, it's okay to sit. You know, we're engineered to sit. We're engineered to conserve energy. It's okay to do that, but don't sit the entire day. Intersperse it with a short walk, intersperse it with some physical activity, whether it's cleaning out a cabinet underneath your kitchen sink, or doing some laundry, or going out and doing some gardening. Interspersed task-related activity where you're challenging yourself by moving in different manners is extremely meaningful, I think. What I'm thinking of is keeping, is not even necessarily longevity in regard to mortality, but longevity in regard to functional independence. Keeping yourself moving and keeping yourself free of the need of assistive devices or assisted living facilities. And I think we can do that. I think we're engineered to do that, barring disease or any type of traumatic injury. HBO has these short documentaries, and they're fantastic. And they did a documentary on individuals who live in Nepal, older individuals who needed cataract surgeries. And these are individuals with, that I guess you could call them poor from a socioeconomic standpoint, but they're very rich in other respects. And they focused on a few different couples. And this one couple was living, looked like a family community top of a mountain. And they had to walk down this mountain path, probably a mile or two, I think, to the bottom to get picked up by the bus to bring them to the clinic where they're going to have their surgery. And this couple, they were both in their 80s, and they were caring for what looked like maybe grandchildren or great-grandchildren. They were preparing food for meals. They were doing some gardening work. They had some livestock that they were taking care of. So the documentary showed this couple engaging in this activity. And what's amazing, what's amazing is that they're moving around very, very well, and they're in bare feet. And when they sit, they're sitting on the ground. They put a mat on the ground, and they sit on top of this mat. And they show them walking down the mountain path in bare feet, and they're at altitude, and they're in bare feet, and they're in their mid 80s walking down this rocky path, and they can't see. Their movement abilities are so far beyond many of our society's movement abilities of someone maybe 30, 40 years younger than them. And the reason why is because they continue to challenge their movement processes throughout the day with continuous activity. They're not running, they're not competing in triathlon, they're not going to CrossFit. They're doing non-exercise activity thermogenesis processes that are meaningful. They have an immediate outcome. They may not be thinking mindfulness, but there's a mindfulness aspect to it probably because there's not a lot of outside noise that they have to deal with while they're doing these activities. That's what struck me about that whole documentary. It was fantastic. They got their eyesight back and you got to see them reunite with their family and maybe see their great-grandchildren for the first time ever. But man, like to watch these older folks walk down that mountain path in bare feet with no sight at altitude in the mid-80s was fantastic.
Wow. So really for, you know, for our audience and people interested in staying independent, the real take home here is to just stay active just throughout the day and do a lot of activities, whether it's around the house, running errands or tasks, just everyday activities, but just do instead of necessarily joining a gym and doing a specific class and then not being active the rest of the day.
That's right. The environments that we live in provide a lot of opportunity to challenge our movement. There's a recent study that came out from, I forget the university, at doing parkour. And the parkour, of course, it wasn't these high load, risky jumps. They were just asking the seniors to negotiate around obstacles within their environment. They brought them to a park and they would be kind of climbing over park benches, sitting on park benches, getting off park benches in a different manner, climbing over a picnic table. Like you would step up onto a picnic table, sit down backwards on the table, swing your legs around, put your legs on the bench on the opposite side, and then get off. And by doing parkour work with these seniors, they were able to improve all the metabolic factors. They looked at, they improved blood work, the cholesterol was lowered, blood pressure was improved, heart rate was decreased. The seniors felt more confident. They improved themselves in balance. There was an engagement in other life activities that wasn't there prior to this type of movement intervention. So there's some risk to it, but I'll argue that there's more risk to not engaging your movement system in that manner. And none of those subjects were hurt, and it was a fantastic outcome. And they were very much engaged in that. So there's opportunity to engage in your movement system and challenge it in a way that's safe. And you can just look at what's around you and see if I can just step over this parking bumper and step back over it again. You're challenging yourself in a manner that you wouldn't challenge yourself in otherwise, had you not done that. And that's meaningful. And you can add that to your normal tasks that you do throughout the day as you increase your physical activity level.
You know, it's fascinating, Peter. It's making me think of when people want to keep their memory strong. You know, some people do crossword puzzles, but just like if you do crossword puzzles, you just get good at doing crossword puzzles faster. It doesn't necessarily make your memory or your mind function better. You need to learn in a natural environment, you know, learning a language, learning a hobby. And this is really analogous, not just to the way our brain works, but to the way our muscles and our musculoskeletal system works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, more input, a variety of input is the best way to improve your motor function.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at what our body really needs. So, Peter, with the time we have left, is there anything you want to mention that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
What I would mention would be that we can't separate movement away from our neuromuscular system in regard to movement processes away from other systems in the body. We have to think of movement being integral, not just in regard to keeping our balance acuity and allowing us to function well and function independently throughout the world, but we have to look at it in terms of how it affects other aspects of our health. If we move, it has a significant effect on our cardiovascular system, our pulmonary system, our endocrine system. There's a lot of interplay between those systems that allow or inhibit movement processes. When you move, you can change the physiology within your body and make your body more vital. You're actually bringing life into it. The ability for you to move better provides an opportunity for you to engage with more of the world. You're creating a bigger life for yourself. If you lose movement, your engagement with the world is going to be reduced as well. You're not going to go out and do some things, and over time, over decades, that results in a lack of independence and pushes you down a road toward some bad problems physically as well as mentally with your health. So movement is a way to think of capturing that ever elusive fountain of youth, if you will.
Yeah, that's a great reminder, Peter. You know, just as, you know, we often say exercise is the best medicine, and it's not just because it makes you burn calories or keeps your muscles strong, but as you're pointing out, it activates and actually, you know, makes our hormones and our nervous system and the rest of our body function better. So we were designed to get a certain amount of exercise for our entire body to function well.
Yeah, it helps with everything. Stress levels, sleep, you know, all that has a play in regard to our health, and none of it is independent from the other.
Yeah. Well, Peter, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing the information, and thanks for doing what you do. I know I have had such tremendous success referring my patients for physical therapy, and the outcomes have been just so tremendous. You know, I've gotten a lot of my patients to functioning well, overcome injuries, and prevent surgery. So thanks for all the great work that you do.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by Emory Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website, emoryhealthcare.org/livewell. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.